Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in program. I'm Brian Shields. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. One of the best-known and most widely read astronomers anywhere, Bob can translate complex scientific concepts into terms that are easily understood by the casual stargazer, yet meaningful to the most advanced researchers. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Again, it's 800-348-2551. Also, you can post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on your Facebook page, on our Facebook page, that is facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Radio using the hashtag VoxPop, and you can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. There's always the telephone, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, thanks for coming in.
Oh, pleasure. Good to be here, Brian.
Bob's book, Zoom, it just went paperback, How Everything Moves. How does everything move, Bob? I have to read the book.
You have to read the book.
Basically, is it a physics book?
Well, this is the first book that I've written of my, you know, lots of them that aren't astronomy. Mm-hmm. Very little astronomy in it. So it deals with snowflakes and glaciers and the poles flipping that everybody's so worried about and moving sand and everyday things. I learned a lot just researching it. For example, give you one example. I never knew that there are bacteria that can cross a kitchen counter in a single hour. I didn't know they ran so quickly.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
800-348-2551. Also, Bob, we've got a big meteor shower coming, the best in years, you say.
Yeah, this is the Perseids, and, you know, the media, generally, not to put anyone down, but, you know, they're not astronomers. So, of course, an editor of a paper or a major network, they see meteor shower and they think, well, let's tell the public. But many of them are just, for example, 2 weeks ago, we had the Delta Aquarius. There were three shooting stars per hour. That's all it could deliver. And it was the night of the full moon, which meant that you would not even see those three. By contrast, coming up this week, we'll have the best in years, a really solid, amazing, amazing meteor shower.
Get away from light, look anywhere in the sky, east,
exactly.
West, north, south.
And we have two nights, which is unusual. Usually it just peaks the night of August 11th to 12th. This year it's going to be Tuesday night, and then again on Wednesday night. Right now the forecast is not that great for Tuesday night, but I still hold out a lot of hope for Wednesday night. That should be pretty amazing.
The phones are very busy. Merle in Argyle, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, go
ahead. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. The question is, what follow-up or what other information have they ascertained from the encounter with Pluto and Charon?
Well, of course, long-awaited, it's the final planet, or even though it's a kind of demoted X-planet that we'll ever see. And so everything was going to be new. We knew very little about it. The diameter was refined. Now we know it's 1,473 miles in diameter, two-thirds the size of the moon, a little more than half the size of the moon. Charon, it does look like the way it's spelt that it should be Charon, but it's Charon. Also an interesting body. And I think just personally that the most fascinating images were the medium close-ups, not the super close-ups. The super close-ups showed us things like mountains made of ice. That's cool to see a mountain range, but as you were approaching it, you saw vast smooth areas in which you could even somewhat imaginatively trace out Pluto the dog on it. So come on, that had to be the winning image as the New Horizons mission was a few days out, and then that kind of medium range pictures I think were the coolest. But information is going to keep coming back for the rest of the year, you know, we're learning lots and lots.
But nothing specific has come back recently.
Oh no, I mean, it's dribbling in every single day. The capabilities of the New Horizons spacecraft with its 23-watt transmitter and the data stream is enough. It has so much stored now from its close encounter that it's going to take the rest of the year and into next year to give us all the information. And it's going to take a while to even get all the images that it took. So we're still learning more and more. Of course, a lot of it is for geeks and planetary geologists and things like that. You know, the composition, the spectral analysis, there's mysteries, of course. Why do you have these?
But anything sticking out right now that's very, very interesting?
To me, it was all interesting just because it was new. But, you know, honestly speaking, was there something in there that twisted your head around and said, whoa, this is like completely new science, new astronomy? No, I don't think so. But, you know, every world out there is its own separate, unique place. And now Pluto finally has something other than a little blobby, tiny, almost dot to it. So it's cool.
Thank you very much for calling, Merle, 800-348-2551. So what happens now with New Horizons? Does it keep going?
Yeah, it keeps going. It's going to go out to the Kuiper Belt. And by changing the course, hopefully we'll be able to get a closer look at one or two additional Kuiper Belt objects, which would have been the more appropriate designation. You know, when Pluto was demoted in 2006 by the International Astronomical Union, they decided to call it a dwarf planet, and they called Ceres, the largest of the asteroids, a dwarf planet. So you have these dwarf planets defined as that they are globular, they're spherical, they're not irregular. But they haven't cleared their neighborhood from all the junk that could be qualifying it as a major planet. Would have been better if Pluto were a Kuiper Belt object, because there's a whole slew of hundreds, probably thousands of icy objects like with names like Makemake and Quarwar and Sedna and Eris out there. So hopefully we'll get a close look at one or two of those too.
You said the mountaintops have ice. Wouldn't all of Pluto be ice? I mean, it's so cold.
Exactly. But there's different kinds of ice. At those cold temperatures, even methane freezes out as ice. Nitrogen on the surface is nitrogen ice instead of gas the way it is here, or the way it is even at Saturn's distance. Saturn's main moon Titan has nitrogen as a gas, as a vapor, but not on Pluto. So there you get it as an icy form. So there's more than just water that can turn to ice, and it has.
I understand the data at the speed of light takes 4 hours.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's far away.
Michael in Cornwall, go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling to find out or just to ask, do you think possibly what connection do you think that these quotes, either from Shakespeare, the fault is in our stars, let's say that as one, and let's say the star in the New Testament at Bethlehem, and any of these other quotes from literature, do you think that there could have been any kind of a scientific or more than that connection with these, or should they just be dismissed?
Well, it's a great topic. Back when in my almost hippie days, I certainly would have loved to see an astrological confirmation that the beloved stars I had already studied astronomy in school.
That was 2 weeks ago, wasn't it?
It seems like it. And I live not far from Woodstock, where we still have that tradition. And I would have loved if my beloved planets, because I love the topic, had effects on our lives and were even more intimately linked than they are. But this was a time when studies started to be done, and especially with computer advent, where they've matched up, they've looked for statistical links between every possible link with astrology, and they all come up empty. And of course, have the time to look at them. But when you ask yourself, well, how would you do such a study? How would you really find it out? I mean, without just being a scientist who just dismisses it without looking at it carefully. But I've written about this. But studies, careful, clever studies, have been done over and over, and they come up so empty that you know you're left with just realizing that this is one of the endless beliefs that came to us from ancient times that don't hold water. And that's why you won't find astronomers who believe in astrology. I mean, there are some who just dismiss it without having looked at it. But I'm talking about if you do look at it. So, you know.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. So did Copernicus and Galileo have any influence? They were scientists, of course, but were they influenced at all by the poetry, the literature, the religion of the day, and how they saw these things? And did they see something other than just stars and planets, I guess?
Well, it was a big tradition back then, of course. And we were just getting over the idea that these moving bodies were not gods. They mm-hmm. were thought to be gods who circled the Earth, not circled the sun. And they weren't made of rocks and metals the way we now know the planets are made of. These were actual gods. And their influence, you know, one was red. So, of course, it must have something to do with fire and blood and therefore influence war. And we still mm-hmm. have a legacy, Brian, in every way, like martial arts, court martial, mm-hmm. coming from Mars. We have the word jovial. Hey, he's jovial, comes from Jove, from Jupiter, believing that it was kind of an upbeat, happy planet. Mercury was the fastest moving them. Why should it be fast? Well, it must be rule changeability. So your Mercury, if it went in retrograde, it had something to do with your changeable life. And Saturn, the slowest moving of them, Saturn takes 29.4577 years to go around the sun. That's real slow. So why is it slow? It must be depressed and heavy, sad. And we have the word Saturnine. Yeah. Even so, even in our vocabulary today, we still have the legacy of the centuries when this was part of life.
Astronomer Bob Berman, more calls in a moment.
Support comes from Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York. Locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating. ApexSolarPower.com for information. Landis Arboretum, Esperance, New York, offering old growth forest, classes, events, and more. LandisArboretum.org. Made possible by the Montgomery County Occupancy Tax, administered by the Montgomery County Board of Supervisors. The Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center, offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care. CECAA.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating and counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction. AlbanyRealtyGroup.com. And the Hyde Collection, Glens Falls, this summer featuring the late drawings of Andy Warhol, 1973 to 1987, organized by the Andy Warhol Museum, one of the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh. HydeCollection.org.
Bob Berman on Vox Pop at 800-348-2551. Ronald in Albany, go ahead.
I'm interested in finding out how you calculate sunrise and sunset. I know it can't be just visual because of the difference in altitude. The mountains, it'll come up sooner, and if you're in a valley, it's not going to come up until later. So is it mathematically done, Bob?
Oh, it is. And back in the old days when we had tables, and back in school, I actually had to do those things. But by the time I was teaching this in college, we no longer did it because it's so, first, we've long ago gone to reference tables with correlated with your latitude and longitude, and nowadays it's calculated in a split second by computer. So lazily, no astronomer has to bother. But I think what you're getting at is it sea level? Yes. Is it the horizon is zero altitude? We don't take the center of the sun, but the first sight of the sun. And then here's the thing that really throws it off, is that the atmosphere is so thick at the horizon, it's 14 times thicker mm-hmm. than when you look overhead, that the sun's image is bent upward by half a degree, which is one sun width at the horizon. So that has to be factored in also. And when you add that, it gives you an extra 6 to 8 minutes, depending upon your latitude, of sunlight a day that you wouldn't get if we were an airless body like the moon, which explains why on the equinox, if you look in your local newspaper, you'll find that days and nights are not equal on the equinox,
yes.
But there's an extra bunch of sunlight on every equinox because the sun's image has been bent upward. So there's a lot to it. And fortunately, neither I nor anyone else has to do it anymore.
Yes, sounds like somebody had a big job at one time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Ronald. 800-348-2551 to Saratoga. Mike.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
My question certainly is not as deep as some of the other ones today, but we were sitting in my neighbor's backyard this past Sunday, probably between 9 and 10 p.m., and saw quite a bright light moving from the top of the sky towards the horizon, faster than like a plane would, in no blinking, but much slower than a shooting star. And my neighbor said that was probably a satellite or a space station. I didn't realize we could see that with the naked eye. Is that true?
Oh, yes, yes, it is. And this is satellite season now from April, even March, right through the end of this month and even into September. All the objects that are orbiting, which are generally from 200 to 600 miles up, are in sunlight during the first 2 hours after nightfall here. So the time of day that you gave was a perfect clue for that. So 9:30, 10 o'clock, there's one every 2 minutes crossing the sky. And they cross the sky in every direction except east to west, because they're launched to take advantage of Earth's spin. That gives them an extra 1,038 mile an hour free payload, which explains why all countries launch from as close to the equator as they can, where the spin is fastest. You know, we didn't choose Cape Canaveral because it's near Disneyland, and the French didn't pick Guyana because they like the wine down there. Everybody's launching where the Earth is spinning fastest, and that means you're going to see these things all moving in the same direction, except, the ones that are north to south and south to north. And these are the spy satellites, which make up at least half of them. So if you just watch the sky for a couple of minutes, you'll see the slow-moving light a little faster than a plane would. If it crosses the sky in a few minutes, if you don't see any blinking port and starboard lights, it's either a UFO mothership or more likely a satellite, and a military satellite if it's got a polar orbit. And you can even tell if it's still functioning. If it's blinking on and off, it means it's tumbling, and that means they just let it go. And there's a few hundred of the ones that are operational and low enough and large enough, meaning about the size of a school bus, so that you'll see it easily during that time. 9 to 10 o'clock is perfect.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep my eye to the sky. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
I saw one the other day, too, but about 2 years ago, I saw maybe three or four in a row following each other, and with the fifth, like, lagging behind. But they had sort of an orangish glow. Were they hitting the sun directly in that arc?
Uh-oh. And this could have been a flashback to when, you know,
2 weeks ago
days.
When you were hippies? Yeah.
Now,
wouldn't they follow each other in the same arc or the same pattern?
Well, there's a few that have been launched deliberately. For example, there's a stereotype spacecraft that are made to follow each other in the same orbit. But when you talk about five in a row at the same height, that you're not going to see. And as soon as they're in a different orbit, they're going to go at a different speed. The lower ones are faster, the higher ones are slower. Of course, reaching the epitome at 22,300 miles high, when they don't have any motion at all. They're absolutely stopped relative to the background stars because they're moving in geostationary orbit at the same rate that Earth rotates. But anything lower than that will have motion against the sky. And the lower it is, the faster.
And they will always have that white star-like color to them?
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you'll see a bright flash. Some of them have giant solar panels, especially the Iridium satellites. And the panels cast the sunlight onto one specific spot on Earth that moves as the satellite moves. So you can actually look up, you put in your latitude, longitude, or your location, and websites will feed back to you. When exactly, what minute, what part of the sky, you'll get a serious flash of light, sometimes bright enough to cast shadows, just for a few seconds, as the previously invisible satellite suddenly has its solar panels aimed your way, and you get this amazing bright flash in the sky.
I think I remember hearing some story about the anniversary of Sputnik, and at the time, people would turn on their radios and could hear the beep. Is that true?
That's the difference in our age. I remember going out and watching it, and people on the streets. This, of course, was October 4th, 1957, looking at the sky and actually seeing it. What we didn't know is that we were all hoodwinked, and the bright light we saw was not the Sputnik itself, but the unneeded, spent final stage of the rocket which was large. Sputnik was only less than 2 feet across, mm-hmm. as I remember. I think it was 22 inches, whereas the rocket that sent it up there was a giant thing. So what we were really seeing was the rocket.
Could you hear it on an AM radio, a beeping or
something?
Yeah,
and the Russians did that, of course, for propaganda purposes, yeah. so that everybody would know, beep, 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 yep, yep.
Let's talk to Willie in New Paltz. Willie.
Hi, Bob. It's Willie Yee from Mid-Hudson Astronomical Association.
Oh, great, Willie. Good to hear your voice.
I had a question about the ultimate fate of the sun. As I understand it, in a few billion years, it's going to become a red giant and then shrink to a white dwarf and then slowly extinguish itself at somewhere near the end of the universe. And I was wondering, do we have any statistics about the probability that it may encounter some other object which will change its fate? It could get, you know, sucked into a black hole or cause another star to go supernova or whatever. Do we have any idea of what the likelihood is of the sun going somewhere else other than a slow white dwarf death?
No, that's very, very, very low probability, as you know. And by the way, all the listeners should remember the Mid-Hudson Astronomy Association. They have programs and they set up telescopes for free in dark sites. So if you look them up, Willie is president of that. The stars, as you know, Willie, are separated by 1 million star diameters from each other. So stars don't generally ever collide with each other. But you're right, the sun's fate, this is the unfortunate future for it. Some 5 billion years from now, it'll turn into a red giant. Maybe its surface will be as far as the orbit of Earth, or maybe even swallow us up. Then after becoming a planetary nebula, a ring, like the Ring Nebula, it'll collapse into an intensely hot, tiny blue star that will promptly cool into a white dwarf star the size of Earth, made only of carbon and oxygen, carbon and oxygen on its surface, except in solid form. And such a white dwarf, that nothing's going to change then. It no longer has any nuclear fuel. It'll not create any heat, but as it shrinks even an inch at a time, the gravitational energy translates into light anyway. So for billions of years, it lives on as a white dwarf, barely shrinking, barely spinning until it loses some heat and turns into a yellow, orange, red, brown, and finally black dwarf. Not a black hole, but black dwarf, and nobody can see it anymore. Briefly, it becomes room temperature. Somebody could stand on it. Wouldn't be a good idea because the gravity would be so strong that would crush you down. And that's the fate of the sun, but we're fortunately talking about billions of years in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Have some sunscreen ready that day, I think, huh?
800-348-2551.
Let's talk to Jim at Adams. Jim, go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hey, it's Mr. Berman. Last night on Weather Channel, they had a program on about the diminution of our Earth's magnetic protective shield by approximately 10%. And they say we're long overdue for a shifting of the poles. Would that correlate with the diminishing of the magnetic field? And they're also talking about the sunspot activity. They predict not too far future here now that we're going to go into a period, they think, of, in fact, they say sunspot activity has been increasing over the years, and they think that we're going to have a much more increased sunspot activity in the next round, and with the diminishing of the Earth's magnetic field, there'll be less protection for the Earth from those blasts from the sun.
Well, I have a feeling that show was written before the before a few years ago, because most solar experts are going the opposite direction and think that this recently very weak solar cycle, number 24, that has followed the deepest sunspot minimum that anyone alive has ever seen, that now that the sunspot maximum has come and gone, it's only half the strength of a normal sunspot maximum, most predictions are exactly the opposite, that we will have a prolonged period of diminished solar activity, diminished flares, diminished sunspots that will actually have a cooling effect on our Earth, in a way come to our rescue a little bit with climate change or global warming, and actually cool the planet a little bit. As for that, you're quite right, 10% decrease in the strength of our magnetic field, plus we have the poles shifting at a faster rate than anyone has ever seen. They're moving an average of 36 miles a year, and that's a lot faster than normal. But nobody knows. We know how often the pole is flipped, 3 times per million years. We know how long it's been, about 700,000 years since the last one. So in a sense, we're overdue. But on the other hand, when it does happen, it takes over 10,000 years always to happen. So if the poles were starting to flip now, the process wouldn't even change for another 10,000 years. Plus, nobody really knows whether a 10% weakening is normal, and that sometimes the Earth's magnetic field gets a little weaker or gets a little stronger. Nobody knows if the movement of the poles sometimes moves more fast and sometimes more slowly, and that what we're seeing now is perfectly normal. The only thing we know for sure is by looking at rocks that have ferrous materials in them, we can tell how the alignment of the poles, where north and south was in history, thanks to the fact that all the particles, when they're when rocks are liquid, lava, and they're solidifying, when they reach 1,414 degrees, called the Curie temperature, the magnetic field of Earth will be solidified into those rocks, because the metal materials will all stand in line for the current lineup of the poles. So that's why we know something like 150 pole flips in the past, going back millions and millions of years. And sometimes, here's the last thing I'll say, because I could go on forever about this, and I shouldn't, is that as little as 50,000 years have passed between the reversal of a magnetic pole, and as much as many millions of years, 30 million years, like we had the Cretaceous Supercron, where the same magnetic polarity was maintained for dozens of millions of years. So there's no rhyme or reason, and believe me, everyone's looked for it. Does it have to do with meteor impacts? Does it have to do with mass extinctions? Does life on Earth change in some way when the poles are flipping? And it turns out they don't. It's never affected biological life. We've never seen new species come or old species getting erased when poles are in the process of reversing themselves. So it obviously has no effect. In fact, the more reasoning, recent reasoning is telling us that even as a pole is flipping, there's always some magnetic shield, even if it's a temporary one, in place, and it really doesn't do much to us. And it's, you know, we can worry about cholesterol and blood pressure, but we shouldn't worry about this. This is not one of the
right. I think it's perhaps written more for the shock value effect to up the ratings of the show on the channel.
It is
channel, Weather Channel. You know, how many people are putting eyeballs on it 24 hours a day?
Yep, you're absolutely right. I'm glad they're doing science for the masses, but yes, you're right. Nothing to worry about.
Thank you very much. 800-348-2551, astronomer Bob Berman at 800-348-2551. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a sincere question, and you sort of mentioned it before, but every year or so I get really interested in this topic, and I get frustrated with the lack of apparent evidence, but every now and then there's a hint, and that's UFOs. So what do you think about the possibility that they've been here, or is it all just a bunch of really fun internet stuff?
Well, the possibility of life, of course, is great. It's a huge universe, and now that we've discovered amino acids in comets and in asteroids, and the idea of panspermia, which is that at least the precursors to life may be riding around in space and maybe raining down on planets, and if the conditions are right, boom, you get life sprouting. And if that's so, life could be common. You know how we're going to know? When we get to Europa and get to those warm, friendly saltwater oceans on Jupiter's moon Europa, because there the conditions have been the same as Earth, where life started on our oceans. They've had the same amino acid bombardment by comets. And if we don't find any kind of life swimming or floating in the oceans there, that would tell us a lot. I think it'd be more likely that there is than there isn't. But what you're talking about is something actually visiting us and present. And here,
yeah,
as an astronomer, most astronomers don't believe in it just because we're watching the sky all the time and we never seem to see these things. And I'm a pilot, and I've been flying my plane for 30 years here in the Hudson Valley, 200 hours of that at night. I've never seen a UFO. So they're avoiding us. If they're there, they're avoiding us. And the final thing is that we're suspicious because they keep themselves hidden if they're there. I mean, we're not all seeing them, and they obviously don't want to come out, you know, the closet, so to speak, because they're staying hidden. They're not landing on the White House lawn. And yet they're spotted by this farmer in Kansas, and this guy in Brooklyn says, oh, I saw it. I saw something. So it seems suspiciously incompetent that they can't keep themselves hidden. They're just spotted once in a while. You'd think that if they wanted to keep themselves hidden, they would just do it. And if they wanted to just make themselves known, they would do that. But this business of, like, occasionally being seen here or there makes us go, I don't know about that. But, you know, who knows for sure? But when you talk to an astronomer, you'll find generally we're skeptical. We tend to be skeptical. Although, you know, I could be an alien instructed to just say this kind of stuff now on these radio shows.
Of course. Of course. I have a follow-up question. Have you heard of Bob Lazar?
No.
He's an interesting internet story, and I'll let you check that out on your own time.
Okay.
And I encourage your listeners to do it, too. But he's got an interesting tale about retro engineering craft and some spectacular claims about elements that don't exist here that are apparently stable on the periodic chart that can give off. I'll let you guys take a look at it, but
I'd be skeptical about that. The thing that makes me have a tiny, tiny bit of open mind is that I get some letters from really sane-sounding physicists who sometimes tell me stories of, and they really don't sound wacky at all. The people don't sound wacky, and they tell me of sightings, reports that I certainly couldn't explain by any known phenomenon.
Thank you very much for calling. What do you think of those theories? You hear them time and time again that, men could not have possibly built the pyramids, so it had to be the aliens. Is that just lazy science?
It is lazy science. It's almost like kind of an ethnocentrism for our time. Like, yeah, we can do these things, but those slobs back in Egypt, even if they had 20,000 slaves or volunteers, no, they could have never done it. But I think it's been pretty explained how with enough manpower you could do that. I don't think you have to invoke aliens for that.
800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. More calls in a moment.
Support comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials. Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Columbia County Tourism, a summer home to classic musicals, theater, waterfront concerts, music, dance, and outdoor films. ColumbiaCountyTourism.org. Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York, an independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. Bodhi Spa Yoga and Salon, Hudson. Daily yoga classes plus haircuts and color, massage, body treatments, and facials. Scheduling hair and makeup services for weddings. BodhiHolisticSpa.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, featuring paved stone to help construct outdoor living spaces. Walkways, retaining walls, pool decks, edgers, fire pits, and more. WhitneysFarm.com. An Autobahn Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of Asian-made and imports, specializing in late-model Volkswagen, Subaru, Audi, and BMW. AutobahnTechnic.com.
Astronomer Bob Berman is here at 800-348-2551. Donald in Red Hook. Go right ahead.
Hello. Thank you for answering my call. I'm curious about the new planet that was found that's similar to Earth, and how long will it take an Earth person to travel there?
Okay. The planet you're talking about is Kepler-542b, and a week or two ago that made all the news because the people at the Kepler mission pretty cleverly I'm trying to avoid the word market it, but that's really what they did by calling it Earth 2.0, you know, like a computer, like Windows 10, Earth 2.0. And so that got the attention of a lot of editors, and this made the front page of the New York Times. That particular planet really should not have gotten that much publicity because although it is an exoplanet, we now know of thousands of them that we've found, and by extrapolation, we know for sure there's at least 20 billion Earth-like planets just in our Milky Way galaxy, just in our own galaxy. Now, this particular one, which is 1,500 light years away, to answer the second part of your question, how long it would take us to get there, forget it, at 1,500 light years. I mean, there's a lot closer exoplanets. 51 Pegasi, the very first one found two decades ago, is, 20 times closer than that. So this particular one, okay, I'll tell you about this one. It was advertised, just as you said, as an Earth twin. In truth, it has 1.5 times the size, 5 times the mass, which is not Earth-like at all, and it has twice the gravity, the surface gravity. And so it's not remotely an Earth twin. We've found other exoplanets that were much more Earth-like. And this particular one, you can't even tell, it's a coin toss, whether this one is going to wind up having a rocky surface the way Earth does, or be a giant Neptune-like ball made of gases. In other words, a gas ball that doesn't even have a surface. So this is one of the discoveries. It's only because of the public's fascination with finding another Earth that if you package it right and you make a discovery, this is going to make the headlines. And we're going to see more discoveries over the next few years. Same kind of thing. They'll keep finding more of them. And if it's packaged right, everyone's going to get excited briefly about it. But, the real news are these are the two big takeaways. One, we finally found one 20 years ago that was 51 Pegasi. And two, we now found thousands more of all kinds. So we know there's billions and billions of planets beyond our solar system that have Earth-like mass and comfortable orbits.
That was good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. You know, when you say Earth-like, that can mean a lot of different things. So is there a planet out there that we know of that if we went there today, we could wear our windbreakers and walk around and breathe the air and drink the water, nothing like that?
No, that's such a great point, Brian, because all we can determine is the mass and in some cases the size if we detect it by photometric means. In other words, the planet's blocking out some of the light of their parent sun, then we can detect the size of this world. But then what? If we know its orbit, which we can determine, we can say, well, that's in a kind of comfortable zone. It could have temperatures like ours. But until we go there, we can't tell if it has a poisonous atmosphere, a crushing toxic properties, or whether it's anything remotely like Earth. So we'd have to really go there. And, you know, we can't do that, not for centuries.
Kathleen in Albany, go ahead.
Hi. My 16-year-old son is interested in astronomy. And I would like to get him a telescope that's functional but not too expensive, and I was wondering if you had any ideas.
It's a big topic. You know, we could easily spend an hour just talking on this because no one telescope does everything. If you want one that doesn't require hassle where you have to collimate the mirrors every other use, then you want a refractor. Those are the kind that you look through, the long kind of skinny tubes. And those are probably the easiest telescope. But there you can't get a large aperture at a reasonable price. Now, some telescopes give a bigger aperture, bigger lens or mirror, so it gathers more light and sees more detail, and they save money by using a cardboard tube or no tracking mechanism. As Earth turns, everything in the sky moves. So within 1 minute, whatever you're looking at disappears from the field of view, and you have to get it back, whereas the better telescopes will follow the object as it moves across the sky. So it's really at least, I'd say, $2,000 to do a telescope that's going to give you a lifetime of satisfaction, and anything else will be a compromise. And just know that. Probably start off with a refractor. Try to get a 3-inch refractor. Again, that's the diameter of that main lens, and that'll show you beautiful views of Saturn and Jupiter and the Moon. Won't be very good with nebulae, won't show galaxies, will show a few star clusters. So every telescope has a has its drawbacks, has its positive, has its negatives. And if you call up a major company that deals with them, like Orion, and speak to a knowledgeable salesperson, they'll tell you all of this honestly. They'll give you the pros and cons of different types of telescopes and what's on sale that month, and they'll be able to help you out. But, expect to spend at least a few hundred dollars.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bob, have you been to observatories. What's the best, biggest one, most exciting thing you looked through and saw at a real observatory?
Well, our observatory outside of Socrates and Woodstock, which we've just refurbished with a new second telescope, it cost me $7,000, or at least would have if I'd paid full price for it. And that's the first refurbishment in 30 years on this. That's kind of a real observatory, but I know what you mean. I'm just trying not to feel
Palomar
bad about it.
Or something.
You're talking about Keck or Palomar, Palomar or Las Campanas in Chile. And we do bring a group every November. We're going again November to visit some of the largest telescopes in the world, which have been built now on either in Hawaii on Mauna Kea at 14,000 feet or in Chile. That's where they're all being built. And they're not set up visually. They tell me that when the president of Spain comes to visit or a dignitary like that once every 2 years or so, they actually have a visual eyepiece. It takes some hours to switch over to something that you could look through. So they will do it on rare occasions, but none of the real telescopes are equipped visually. And to tell you the truth, almost all time spent in telescopes is on spectroscopy, not even in taking pictures, but on analyzing the light with very technically through equipment, sometimes that has 50 different places in it to analyze 50 different spots on it and break the light up into its component wavelengths, and it's read out as it wiggles on graphs. And so it's nothing the way people imagine. So nobody really looks through telescopes anymore.
Nobody's squinting in one eye at the end of the Palomar.
That's a century or so since that was what astronomy was about.
Let's talk to Rich in Hyde Park. Rich?
Hi, guys. Great show. I'm hoping we can resolve a conflict in my mind from what I've seen, you know, from public information on astronomy. So from Hubble's research, we've been told that the universe is expanding out in all directions, and any point is the center point, so everything's moving away from each other. But then we've also been told that someday Andromeda Galaxy will collide with our own. And I don't understand how that could happen. And then there's a weirder thing I also saw on one of the science shows on TV, somebody theorizing about falling into a black hole. They were saying that it would appear that everything in the universe is moving away from you. And then wouldn't that explain Hubble's observations? And could we be falling into a black hole?
All right. Black hole's a different story. So let's just take the basic one of the universe expansion. And that becomes easy to understand if you just realize that, first of all, what you said is right. No matter where you are in the universe, you're at the place where the Big Bang happened, and therefore everything is flying away from you. And the only notation, asterisk, that you put on that is that there are clumps that hold together, and these clumps are galaxy clusters. Now, we live in a cluster of galaxies with the unimaginative name of the local group. We live in the local group. And in our local group, there's also the Andromeda Galaxy. So within each cluster of galaxies, there's no expansion. And that's why the Andromeda Galaxy can actually approach us. And it is doing so at 70 miles per second, so that we can actually collide with Andromeda in about 4 or 5 billion years. That's in our local group. But within the local group, every other group of galaxies is expanding away from us. And for every million light years further we look, they're expanding 14 miles per second faster. So that's the rate of expansion, 14 miles per second per million light years. And so it's additive. If you're going to look 100 million light years away, then it's 100 times 14, 1400 miles per second is the expansion rate for galaxies at that distance. And so it's pretty straightforward. Now, with black holes, it's a completely different story because space-time itself is totally warped. And if you were to fall in a black hole, what you would see is very different from what anyone else would see watching you fall in. Anyone watching you would see you just freezing at the edge and never going any further. And in fact, we don't even see a black hole completely forming because the material that's falling in freezes and stops because time comes to a stop there. There's no passage of time relative to the rest of the universe. But that's not the case for you if you're actually falling in. You see something else, and then you get into Einstein's reference frames, that there's different realities depending upon who's asking, depending upon whether it's your perception falling in or whether someone else watching you fall in. You'd have completely different takes on what was going on. And so very special case, black hole.
Okay, I'm very satisfied with the first answer, and I'll keep thinking about the second one.
Thank you very much for calling. If you did fall into a black hole, wouldn't your atoms and molecules just be yanked apart at a very painful pace?
You'd be yanked towards the center, and how painful it would be depends on the mass of the black hole. Paradoxically, the more massive the black hole, for example, we have a black hole at the center of galaxy M87 in Virgo that has the same mass as 9 billion suns. Black hole like that, it's gentle. Mm. As you pass the event horizon and fall in further, you don't feel any change. You can't even tell you've entered the black hole. The only real change is your cell phone text messages never get returned anymore.
Let's see. Joel in East Bern. Joel, go ahead.
Hi. Appreciate you taking my call. Just a comment and then your commentary on one other issue. Recently, the town of Bern purchased a mountaintop called the Game Farm, and they were... some group was petitioning to put an observatory up there. Do you know anything about that?
Is that here in
it's Albany County?
Yeah, Bern, New York.
Oh, you know, I didn't know anything about it, but good luck to them. A new observatory, that would be great. I'll cheer for them.
It was in the Alpine Enterprise, and I'm a resident right near there, and was just curious about it.
Good. I hope they succeed.
The other question I had was... recently in the news, there was a thing about an electro pulse propulsion that they had proven that was capable, and it came out of, I guess the paper came out of Germany. Do you know anything about that?
Well, plasma propulsion, if that's what we're talking about, was used in the Stardust mission to Vilt 2, the comet Vilt 2, and it was very successful. Instead of using chemical production, where you get a huge amount of power, but the thrust only lasts seconds or minutes, here you can have propulsion that's very weak and wimpy, but which continues for weeks or months at a time, so that the rocket slowly and the mission slowly gains speed, but all of that speed is additive, and it's an appropriate way to reach very distant objects. The way they succeeded in reaching that comet. So this is probably a breakthrough in that plasma propulsion, and it's one other way of doing things, and a good way of doing things.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Sure. I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you for calling. Astronomer Bob Berman, Craig in Rosendale. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. I have a question about the age of the universe. Am I correct that it's estimated to be a little less than 20 billion years old? And that's based on the most distant objects that we can detect?
Well, 13.7.
Okay. And is that right, that it's based on how far away we can see?
That's based on just extrapolating backwards, mostly from the expansion of the universe that we were talking about. If you get that, the Hubble constant we were just discussing, 14 miles per second faster for every million light years of distance, you could just go the other way, extrapolate in reverse, and see that everything was in one place at one time in the past. There's a few extra wrinkles, and that is the universe suddenly increased its rate of expansion when it was half the current age, when it was about 7 billion years old. It started flying away. Everything started flying away faster than it had before. But when you add that in, yeah, you get that current age, which also yields a distance to the farthest galaxies of about 40 billion light years, the farthest galaxies. So you have an age of the universe of 13.7, but you have the increase in the expansion of space, which actually allows objects to be almost 40 billion light years away, although you can't see them because they're way over the horizon where light could ever reach us.
Right. So it seemed a little dubious to me that the Earth could be close to 6 billion years old, like almost half the age of the whole universe itself. I guess one thing I was wondering is when you hear about we're in a galaxy and there's a galaxy cluster and then there's a supercluster, is it possible that there's a super-duper cluster that we haven't detected yet that's much, much further away so that the age of the universe might be much, much larger?
Well, it might be. I mean, the universe could be infinite in age. That's the newer thinking, that there's a lot we don't know. We're working on models right now, and because to make up for the lack of information. Earth seems to be about 4.5 billion years old. That's well in keeping, considering that we're going around a star that's not a first-generation star. Our sun did not start out at the birth of the universe, and it's a third-generation star. So the age of Earth fits in very well with that. But so far as the whole universe goes, still a lot of mysteries.
And we've got to wrap it up there. We're out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Astronomer Bob Berman, thanks for stopping in today.
Pleasure.
Support for WAMC comes from Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors, serving the Northeast since 2001. StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie presenting Surrounded, sampling Birchfield's wallpaper with original designs and watercolors by Charles Birchfield through September 20th, arkellmuseum.org. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com and SPAC hosting the Philadelphia Orchestra. 12 performances featuring modern to classic with musicians from across the world through August 22nd. SPAC.org for tickets. Again, thank you for joining us today on Vox Pop. Our engineer, Zach Malloy. Calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Brian Shields. Tomorrow it's Food Friday on Vox Pop. The news is next.